For the last several weeks, we have been exploring together the theme of when God shows up. Oftentimes, we see stories in the Bible that show us that God, when He does show up in our lives, shows up in ways that we often don't expect. And the same is true in today's story as we look together at Daniel chapter 3. The scripture reading this morning was a bit long, but I think that's for good reason. We need to get the whole story of what takes place with three individuals, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and how that in a very unexpected way, God shows up just when they need Him to. Throughout the Bible, the idea of fire or a furnace of fire is often used to depict times of suffering, and more specifically, times of pressure, when believers in God and those that are a part of God's family experience pressure for what they believe from the world around them. You've probably been there. Many people in our audience this morning have experienced what these three experienced: pressure from those around you because you took a stand for what you know God says is true. Some of you might have taken pressure from your families whenever you decided to put Jesus first in your life. Maybe your family disowned you, or your family didn't want anything to do with you anymore because you took a stand for what you knew God said was right. Some of you maybe have experienced the pressure at the workplace, because it's not very popular these days to take a stand for what is right, and maybe you have been castigated or even your job threatened because you went through the fires of that pressure. In the last decade or two in our country today, it has become increasingly unpopular for Christians to take a stand for what is right. And we know what it's like to feel that pressure, perhaps now more than ever in our country, for standing for what God says is right. Well, in our story today, we see that God shows up, and He shows up in the fire too, in the times of pressure, when the furnace and is burning hot and the flames are licking at our feet. God, in fact, does show up. In our story today, we are introduced to three individuals, in fact, really four, when you look at the broad scope of this story: Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These four individuals, their way of life as they have known it has been completely turned upside down. Let me show you what I mean. You turn back to the first chapter, in Daniel chapter 1, in verse number 1, you see that these four individuals, their homeland has been invaded by a foreign enemy. King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon has besieged Jerusalem. Their religion has been desecrated in chapter 1 and verse 2. The sacred vessels of worship to the true God, Yahweh, in the temple have been taken away and placed in the treasury of a foreign god. And thirdly, the brightest and the best individuals of the land of Judah have been deported and taken to Babylon to be indoctrinated and brainwashed by a new culture and new values. Chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. You see, the way Nebuchadnezzar went about it when he conquered a land like Judah was he would take the professional classes of people, those that showed the most potential, and he would reprogram them, indoctrinate them, and brainwash them into becoming Babylonian wise men. What he would effectively do was really extremely savvy as far as subjugation of people is concerned. He would force them to be obedient to Babylon by assimilating them through the indoctrination of his culture. And most surprising of all, chapter 1 and verse 2 tells us that the Lord gave His people over to all of this. This didn't happen because Nebuchadnezzar and his army was more powerful. This didn't happen because someone did something innovative to be able to overwhelm Judah. But Daniel tells us the Lord gave them over to all of this. Israel had continually disobeyed God, and Daniel says in his prayer in Daniel chapter 9 and verse number 11 that God allowed Judah to fall to the power of Babylon. So Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their worlds have been completely turned upside down, and they now find themselves in a completely foreign and new culture. But interestingly enough, these four young men thrive in their new environment. They thrive and are extremely successful in their lives in a foreign culture, all the while refusing to compromise their spiritual convictions. In chapter 1, verses 17 through 21, we find that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego seek the welfare of the city of Babylon. They follow the Lord's directions that He had given earlier through the prophet Jeremiah in Jeremiah chapter 29, and they enter into public service in Babylon. They pray for the city, seek the welfare of the city. And as a result, Daniel is made the ruler of all the wise men of Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are made chief administrators in the city. And so they seek the welfare of Babylon, and they thrive and are extremely successful. And yet, all the while engaging their culture, by being involved in their culture, they maintain their convictions and their loyalty to God. Chapter 1 and verse 8 shows that they refuse to defile themselves with the unclean food that was offered them by the king, refusing to yield to the political correctness of Babylon and the pluralism that infected that culture. We see that especially in our text today in Daniel chapter 3. When we pick up in Daniel chapter 3, we find ourselves on the plain of Dura. And on that plain, King Nebuchadnezzar has constructed a statue 90 feet tall, a statue of pure gold, and he has commanded all of the subjects of his land, when they hear the sound of any musical instrument play on the plain, they are to bow down in worship to this statue. And if you don't, you will be thrown into my fiery furnace, says the king. Well, let's look at that statue for just a second. What did the statue represent? King Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 3 and verse 14, you'll notice, says something that gives us an insight into what this statue represented. The king says in Daniel 3:14, Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to the three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up. Now, the Hebrew is a little tricky here, but I'm told by Hebrews, those that study such things, that in the Hebrew, the word or that is in many translations could be translated for. And so he's essentially saying, why are you not serving my gods, plural, by way of worshiping this golden image? And so that's important because really what this statue represented was not, what was not happening is what we might tend to think. He had not established a singular golden image that represented the god, singular, of Babylon, and he's saying you need to bow down and worship it. Instead, what King Nebuchadnezzar has done is keeping in his most savvy strategy for assimilating a diverse group of people that have been brought in from every nation under heaven that he's conquered. How can he make them assimilate and become a unified people? The way he does it is not only by indoctrination and brainwashing of the elite classes, but also by erecting a statue that he essentially says this statue represents all of the gods. And so you need to recognize all of the gods and bow down before all of them. So you see, the king is not demanding that they serve his god, but rather that he is serving, instead of serving his god or their god, they should in fact, he is demanding, serve all of the gods. And what he's saying is, not you should come over to my side and serve my God as opposed to serving your God. You can still serve your God, but you must also serve the gods in addition to your God. So the idea is this. This statue represents something we are all too familiar with in our culture today. It is the idea of pluralism. The idea of pluralism says that you need to coexist and recognize everybody's view as being equally valid. And what does pluralism do? Pluralism hates those that take an exclusivistic stance. Anybody in a culture that is pluralistic, that stands up and says, my way is the right way, this is truth, or this is the one and only God, is branded a heretic or an extremist or a fundamentalist, or even worse, some threat to the society. So you see, with Babylon being a pluralistic and a multinational city, it was literally a melting pot, much like America today. The king is trying his best to find a way to bring uniformity across his culture. He is essentially saying to his subjects, you may worship your gods as long as you never say that your God is the only God. He is demanding that everyone religiously coexist, requiring everyone to bow down and acknowledge the validity of every religion represented in the culture. You see, pluralism hates exclusivists. But pluralism also requires, for you to be able to function in that culture, what it essentially says is, you must privatize your faith. In other words, you can worship whatever God you want to personally. That's your business. Your faith is private, but keep it private. In your private life, you worship your God, but in public, you must be like everybody else. You must embrace the values and the religions that everybody else embraces. You see, all pluralistic cultures, whether ancient Babylon or modern America, work in the same way. The pressure, the fire is the same. It says that you can privately believe anything you want to, but publicly you gotta be like everybody else. It is always seeking to assimilate you into the public culture by making you privatize your faith. But these three men in Daniel chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refused to give in to this pressure to privatize their faith. When the instruments play and the crowds of people on the plain of Dura bow their faces to the ground before the statue, there are three men that are left standing, refusing to give in to this pluralistic culture. Well, guess what? If you're a Christian today in America, you are under the same pressure. And if you don't know that you are, you probably have already given in to it. If you're not at some point, and if I'm not at some point in my life taking it on the chin for what I believe, then that probably means I've already given in to the pressure. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to give in. They refused to bow, and they made the most bold declaration of faith, one of the most bold, in all of the pages of the sacred record. When they say in Daniel chapter 3, look at it in your own Bible, Daniel 3 verses 16 through 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Listen to the bold declaration of the faith of these three men. They say in the first place, God can save us. The God we serve, the true God, is able to save us. They declare their confidence, their utter conviction that God is able to save them from the licking flames of that burning furnace. But secondly, they declare, not only do we believe God can, we believe that He will. They had a personal conviction that God would in fact deliver them from the hand of the king, but then most powerful of all is the third conviction. And they say this, we believe God, we know God is able to deliver us, we believe He will deliver us, but even if He does not deliver us, we still will refuse to bow down to your image and bow to your gods, because they would not allow themselves to be given over to these false gods. They would die for their principles. Much like Job that we looked at in a previous lesson, these three men are declaring that they would serve and love God simply for Himself, not for anything that God would do or anything that they would get out of God. They say, but if not, even if we die in the furnace, so be it. We still will not bow down. We are loyal to God and we love God no matter what. We simply love Him for what He does, for who He is, not for what He does. But you see, often in the fires of life, for you and me, our hearts have a hard time getting there, don't they? You see, for a lot of us, and I've talked to a lot of individuals over the years in personal discussions and counseling sessions, for many of us, when the fires of life come, we'll say something like this, either to ourselves or sometimes we'll be courageous enough to say it to others. We'll say something like this in a moment of complaint. We'll say, you know, I have lived a good life. I've always gone to church. I've served God. But then when my time of need came and I asked God for something really important, He didn't come through for me. Well, I want to say to you and to me that if we say that kind of thing, we never really have been serving and loving God. We've been serving and loving our own agenda. That we basically will only serve and love God when God will do what we want Him to do, like a heavenly butler. That really the only thing we're trusting in such a scenario is our own agenda. And if our agenda doesn't come through, if God doesn't do what we want Him to do, then we abandon Him. But not so with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it shouldn't be with us either. These three were saying to the king, we serve and love God, period. We love Him and serve Him, even if He doesn't save us from the furnace. As one preacher put it, these three love God precisely, not God plus something. They just love God. And that is the key to facing any circumstance in life, no matter how hot it may be. You see, these three men knew that although God might save them from death, they were sure He would always save them through death. That's an important statement. God may or may not save you from death, but He will always, if you rest and trust in Him, save you through death. So if you have utter conviction, utter confidence, you are absolutely 100% certain that God will save you through death, then you can take anything life throws at you. Because you know that when you die, you will wake up in the arms of the Lord, and therefore you're always safe. You can handle anything life throws at you. Why? Because you don't trust God plus what God does, or God plus something. You simply trust in God alone. If you love God just for Himself, as one author said it, you will be spiritually fireproofed. Because no matter what fires come your way, you have been fireproofed from them because you are confident that in any situation, God may or may not save you through death, but He will save you, or may not save you from death, but He will definitely save you through it. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is hot with fury. He's as hot as the flames themselves, angry at what these three men say, and he has them bound and thrown them into the furnace, a furnace that he has instructed to be heated seven times hotter than it normally is, verse 19. And after they're thrown in the furnace, the king, from some vantage point, is able to peer in and look into those flames, and he sees two astonishing things. Number one, he sees that these men who had been bound are now loose, and they're walking around in the flames. Walking around in there. And then secondly, he sees another thing that shocks him. There's not just three anymore, but there is a fourth individual there. Let's pick up at verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to the counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" And they answered and said to the king, "True, O king." And he answered and said, "But I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Scholars have debated for centuries the identity of the fourth person in the flames of the fiery furnace. Later in the text, in verse 28, King Nebuchadnezzar says that the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego has sent his angel. So there's a variety of possibilities here. It could be that God simply sent an angel of protection to watch over Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and save them, much like Daniel is saved from the lion's den in that fiery furnace. Another possibility is that this person in the flames is the angel of the Lord. Not just any angel like Gabriel, but a specific angel, an angel referred to throughout the pages of the Old Testament as the angel of the Lord. He's referred to often, and he's very unique because the angel of the Lord is never just a messenger who speaks in behalf of God, but when he speaks as if he's speaking, as it's God speaking himself. Which has led many scholars to believe that the angel of the Lord is in fact really not an angel in the strictest sense, but rather is a messenger sent by God that is in fact the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ himself. The Spirit of Christ before he is born of the Virgin Mary has always existed, and sometimes he is sent at strategic times. At the very least, we know that what God is doing is he's sending his presence to protect these three men. And he's watching over them. I tend to think, although I don't think Nebuchadnezzar had a concept of it when he said, "This is the son of the gods," he may have been saying something prophetically that he didn't really fully understand himself. I tend to believe that this is the pre-incarnate Jesus. That is present. He's showing up in the flames. You know, you or I, when we go through the times of pressure for our faith and flames of the furnace, you will only feel Jesus with you in the fire. To the degree that you know that Jesus was thrown in the ultimate fire for you. The great revivalist preacher of the 18th century, Jonathan Edwards, once preached a sermon. You can read it for yourself on the internet. It's called Christ's Agony. And in that famous sermon, Edwards tries to preach on and depict for us the agony that Jesus faced whenever he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, bowing before the Father, praying so earnestly that he begins to sweat profusely droplets of blood. We see the agony of the Christ as he is anticipating the immense suffering that he would endure for you and me. And in that sermon, Edwards speaks of Jesus' agony, and he says, "Jesus had in that garden that night a near view of the furnace of wrath, which was vastly more terrible than Nebuchadnezzar's fiery furnace. He was brought to the mouth of the furnace into which he would be cast, that he might look into it and stand and view its raging flames and feel the glowings of its heat, that he might know where he was going and what he was about to suffer. This was the thing that filled his soul with sorrow and darkness. This terrible sight, as it were, overwhelmed him. What Edwards is saying is, as Jesus prayed in that garden, the reason he was sweating so profusely and overwhelmed with such agony is that what God was giving him was a glimpse into the furnace, the ultimate furnace of suffering and wrath that he was about to enter. And basically he was saying, here's a foretaste of it, so that Jesus would know what he was facing and still choose to surrender to the Father's will. And still choose to walk into that furnace with us. Rather, I should say, for us. Because Jesus was thrown in the ultimate furnace that would deliver us so that none of us would know the wrath that we deserve. King Nebuchadnezzar, in the end of Daniel chapter 3, again speaks, I think, prophetically, when in chapter 3 and verse 29 he says, in astonishment, after the three men have been delivered from the furnace, they're not even harmed, not even the skin or the hairs on their arms are singed. They're completely untouched by the flames. He's so astonished that he says, "For there is no other God who is able to rescue like this." No other God. And that is absolutely true. The way of salvation that Jesus presents to us, to you and me in the gospel, is radically unique from all other religions of the world. Because every other way of salvation, you see, every religion in the world has a way of salvation that they present, and every other way of salvation in every other religion is based on your performance. It is based upon you keeping the rules, you living a good life, you having a good moral record so that God will save you. But if that is your view of salvation, if you think your way of salvation is based upon what you do and how well you perform, then what's going to happen to it when times of suffering come? What's going to happen to your faith when the flame comes? If that is in fact your view of salvation, I'll tell you what will happen. You'll either hate God by saying, "I've lived a good life, I've been a moral person, why are you letting this happen to me?" And you'll hate Him. Or you'll hate yourself by saying, "If I'd only lived a little better, if I'd only done a little bit more, this wouldn't be happening to me." And you'll live in despair and depression. You see, every other God and every other religion and every other way of salvation is based on your good works and your moral effort. But if you go into the furnace of life with that belief, it will destroy you. The king was right. This way is utterly unique. There is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Because what does he do? It's not based upon you rescuing yourself. He comes to rescue you. You see, if you say when you're in the furnace of life, when you feel the flames of pressure licking around you, you will say to yourself, when you know what God has done for you through Jesus, you will say to yourself, this is a much cooler, as hot as it is a much cooler, much smaller furnace. And I am not being punished for my sins because Jesus already took the much hotter, much bigger furnace for my sins and He paid for it there. See, Jesus suffered not so that we wouldn't suffer, but Jesus suffered so that when we do, we might become like Him. I want you to know this morning that Jesus is in the fire with you. But you will only feel it, you will only realize it, when you come to know that He went through hotter fires than you will ever go through. and He did it for you. Will you this morning let your heart accept that? Will you come to know the agony of what Jesus went through to pay for all of your sins so that He might deliver you? He may not save you from the fires that you're experiencing, but I can promise you He'll save you through it. Will you trust in Him today? Will you believe that He is a God like no other? That no one else and nothing else can save and rescue you like He. Will you give your life to the one, the only, true God of heaven and His Son whom He has sent? Will you come and believe in Jesus and surrender your life to Him, believing in Him, confessing Him to be the Lord of your life, turning away from yourself and surrendering completely to God simply by virtue of who He is, because He is beautiful and worthy and majestic and all-powerful. He is the God that breathed life into you. He's the reason you're breathing right now. And He's the one to which you are rushing right now. Every minute that ticks on the clock is one step further toward meeting Him. Will you surrender to the most beautiful and majestic of all gods, the one and true God? Will you give your life to Him and be surrendered in baptism and give your life to Jesus? Or if we can pray for you, if we can help you in any way, come to Him as we stand and as we sing.